What is going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of The Bog. We have a very special episode, special guests here. You guys are going to absolutely love it. But before we get started, make sure you like, subscribe, share, click the little alert button so you get alert every time we go live. It's every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern right here on Dave Martell channel. We have a double episode this week for our Bogmas special. It's going to be here right now, this episode, with our guests that I'm about to introduce here soon. But also we have... After this, so stay tuned, stay seated. After this episode, there will be Metaphysics of Strength with the mighty Jack Young. You guys are absolutely love it. So anyway, without further ado, actually, before we get started, shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, Traditional Apothecary, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the vampires that hate your guts and sell you poison. Stop buying that stuff. Support folk economies. So go to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com, promo code Dave to get 10% off. So I'm going to introduce my co-host and our guest for this evening. We're going to do a Santa Claus episode. It's going to be really good stuff. Tristan, how are we doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing just fine, Dave. Happy to be on.
And we have everybody's favorite, the very Indo-European Mr. Tom from Survive the Jive. Everybody knows.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me back again, and glad to be here this Christmas.
My pleasure, sir. My pleasure. Yo, everybody already knows Tom, man. We love our man. I watch all your videos. I absolutely love your videos. I saw your documentary about the Anatolia. Your most recent one about the Celtic peoples was absolutely wonderful. But on top of all of your great content you have coming out of your YouTube channel, you also have a book, a Christmas story. Tell us about it.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. I did 2 years ago, two Yules ago, did an animated story with a guy, a talented artist called Christopher Steininger, who used to work for Marvel Disney, and he decided to branch out into something a bit more alternative. And this is a Christmas ghost story that is like animated about a Victorian guy in like 1888. He goes to midnight mass on Christmas Eve, and then he's walking back through the woods, and he gets transported through time to the to another time, basically to the Anglo-Saxon time, where there's a mead hall, and he witnesses how Yule was celebrated by our pagan ancestors in the old times. And everyone loved the cartoon so much that they were like, why can't you do this as a book, as a book that we can, you know, have in our homes and read to our children as a picture book? So the following year, last Christmas, we had that done. We had it printed, and now we're selling it off of Christopher's website, smiletitans.com. And I've got underneath this Julebok, the Swedish Yule goat, I have a copy that you can see. So it's a Spirit of Yule, and you get these little, not really lovely illustrations that he's done.
Oh, yes, yeah, so the artwork is just really nice in it. I noticed that first thing.
Yeah, it's a hardback. It's nice if you've got kids, but to be honest, if you haven't got kids, it's still cool because you get these pictures of Odin and stuff and mead halls. And the story I've done is I've done a lot of research for it. So a lot of people online, there's a lot of videos where people talk about the pagan origins of Yule. And I'll be honest, not all of it is properly sourced. This introduction I have for the book here, I've explained everything in the book and the sources that prove it. And they're not modern sources. They're, you know, contemporary pagan sources from Byzantium or from Icelandic sagas. So the way that the pagans in this celebrate Yule is legit. This is a legit account of it. So it's not only a fun way to educate your child about paganism, but it's you could educate yourself a little bit maybe.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Always man. Good.
Yeah, me and Tristan being colleagues over at the Nerona Society. Anybody that's familiar with Nerona Society knows we love sources. You get into a conversation with anybody from Nerona, get ready for a wall of text full of sources and citations and stuff like that. So we really like that stuff. So just to get into your book a little bit, how long was the process? What was the process like? And is this your first published work?
Yeah, I mean, I was a journalist for a while, so I had a lot of articles published in magazines and things. So I guess that counts as being published, but this is my first book. And I didn't think I'd do a children's book, but I had actually always wanted to. And I used to think about doing a comic book or something like that for years. I lived with a comic book artist for a while, and I was always trying to get him to work with me on something, and he just didn't think that he would like to work with me. But then I got approached by this guy, Christopher, to do that cartoon, and we subsequently did another cartoon as well, which was about Indo-European myths about apples, which is on his channel too, the Smile Titans channel, and that you can look at the myths of the sacred apples. You can see that where I compare the Celtic and the Germanic and all the different myths about the sacred apples and speculate that where they come from. But the book idea came from a comment in the YouTube section. Someone just commented it. And because Christopher had worked in publishing a lot as a comic book artist in Canada for a long time, he just knew how to do things. And he took a lot of the initiative with it. And they're all in Europe, but he arranged it all from Canada. So my job is the marketing and the advertising and to write the story. But he did all the logistics for getting it printed and everything. So it was quite a simple process. And like as for the actual creation of the story, like he said, would you like to work together? And I know he'd worked on an animated Christmas story for children. From his IMDb, it shows that. So I was like, I'd like to do an animated Christmas thing too. And I also saw how he'd worked on an animated version of a H.P. Lovecraft story. So he was into horror, and I'm really into Lovecraft and horror and folk horror.
Yeah,
and stuff
absolutely.
Like. So I thought, you know, maybe I could use the horror genre, folk horror, which is my favorite form of genre of horror, subgenre, to tell a ghost story for Christmas. And ghost stories for Christmas are actually a tradition in Britain, because not only did the BBC run a series starting, I think, in the 1970s that ran all through the 80s and 90s as well. They kept on doing it, called Ghost Story for Christmas, where they basically tell ghost stories set at Christmas time. And they work so beautifully because there's something about the midwinter that does feel like a time of the dead. And we as pagans know why that is. But the other reason is, of course, that modern Christmas, as we understand it, is somewhat invented by Charles Dickens. And Charles Dickens' story, A Christmas Carol, is a ghost story. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the 1840s or whatever, 1850s. I don't know, remember when it came out.
Yeah.
So this book, I wrote the story, is very, very deliberately Dickensian. And it also references, as well as referencing like the old pagan ways of doing Christmas, there's this intermediary figure who is the Green Knight. And the Green Knight is a figure from Arthurian folklore from the late Middle Ages. And he appears at Christmas time to play tricks, magical trick on the on certain members of the court of King Arthur. So I thought he would be a good intermediary figure to bring this Victorian Dickensian Christmas person through time back to the Anglo-Saxons, because he's in between them. So I wanted to show that there's a link between the Victorian Christmas, the Middle Ages Christmas, and the Anglo-Saxon Yule, and that it's all our ancestors, and it's all this thing, and I want to just try to bring it all together and in the form of this tradition now that's over 150 years old of the ghost story for Christmas.
Yeah.
Right. I was actually going to ask about the Green Knight and what he has to do with Christmas here, but I think you answered most of that there. Yeah. I would ask, is it something that is traditionally associated with Christmas in modern England, the Green Knight? And also
only anyone who knows about him. Most people in England don't know who the Green Knight is, because most people in England haven't read Middle English literature from the Middle Ages. There is the story he appears in is called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and it's set at Christmas. The actual story isn't all at Christmas. It begins at Christmas. The Green Knight appears, sets a challenge for the court, and then that is taken by Sir Gawain, who has to meet it by the following Christmas. So it begins at Christmas and it ends at Christmas. It's certainly a Christmas-based story.
I have a friend that is very into the Arthurian legends himself from a Celtic pagan perspective, and he believes that these sort of traditions are primarily Celtic in origin. Do you think it is, in fact, Celtic, or is it more Germanic-influenced?
I wouldn't actually say necessarily that the dichotomy offered there is useful, whether it's Celtic or Germanic. Mm-hmm. Certainly King Arthur in his original Welsh form is a Celtic person. He was a Roman, if he existed, it was a Romanized Celt. But Arthurian legend has almost nothing to do with the historical figure of Arthur, if he existed. He has everything to do with the court of the Anglo-Norman aristocracy or in Britain, in Wales, and in England in the late Middle Ages, and also with the French courts, who were among whom the stories were very popular. So the stories of King Arthur, some of them come from France, some of them come from Wales, some come from England, but they're not, the ones from England aren't Anglo-Saxon, and the ones from, you know, they're all kind of, all of them are, frankly, Christian morality tales for the time, but they are not, that does not mean that from our pagan perspective, we can say, oh, they're useless. Unless we can connect them back directly to a pagan tradition, then we must say that they're all Christian nonsense. But that's not really correct. And if you want to know more about that, I really recommend the book by Julius Evola about the Grail. What's it called? I got it over there, but I can't remember. I read it, but I can't remember the title. He has a whole book about the Grail myth, and it's about how, like...
Right, the mystery of the Grail, initiation and magic.
Initiation and magic, the mystery of the Grail. So basically, it's about the esoteric symbolism of the Grail and the Grail myth, and Arthurian myth has this kind of secret aspect to it. And a lot of those themes derive from ancient Indo-European notions of kingship and of warriors going on quests and things like that, and they're not really very Christian, although Christian morality is also a central element in the stories. There's kind of a Christian morality that modern Christians would not understand, is completely alien to the kind of modern Catholic Church or the modern Protestants. It's something that the High Middle Ages of a very warrior centric
Teutonic Christianity.
Yeah, it's quite Teutonic, and I'm certain, of course, your friend was right to say that there are Celtic themes in Arthurian myth, of course, because much of it comes from old Celtic stuff. Some Celtic legends have been woven into it, but a lot of it is innovative, and also even, you know, some of the stories were invented in Germany, so... Of course, you know, like, but then to call them either Celtic or Germanic implies that they have a provenance dating to the times when Celtic and Germanic, you're talking about Celtic and Germanic religions. And the idea Celtic religion hadn't existed in Britain for like 1,000 years at the time the Arthurian literature is being written. So it's really...
Right. I always come back to the issue that when you're deciding whether something is Celtic or Germanic like that, and you don't have the actual provenance where it's from that actual culture, they can be melded and mixed together to such a degree that it's very difficult to decide which is which, because they have the same root origin to begin with, and in the Indo-European peoples.
And Tom, you, in your last video you did about the Celtic peoples, I was actually really shocked when you laid out the evidence showing how similar these two cultures actually were, and how they're both very much just Indo-European and different expressions of the Indo-European migrations and stuff like that. Because throughout, you know, those of us that are part of like the Also True movement or the pagan community or whatever, there's always been kind of like this rift between Germanic and Celtic. And I think you sort of broke that rift down in that video and showed that these cultures are very, very similar.
Well, yeah, definitely. Like the cultures are similar. You know, there's a really great article by Stephen McNallan on that. I can't remember where it was published, but he did a whole article where he described the court culture of ancient Celtic pagans and just said this is exactly like Germanic one. You've got mead halls. You've got a lord around whom there is a retinue who are devoted to him in service. You have sacrifices to the gods, libations. You have the bards who sing ancient songs of the people, which it's all the same.
It's very familiar to any Nordic or Germanic practitioner.
Certainly, and this is because, for a large part, because it's Indo-European in origin, and also, more specifically, because these two distinct Indo-European cultures both developed in Northern Europe. So, north of the Alps, I mean. So they both developed in Germany, in Denmark and in the British Isles, etc. So of course they're going to have similarities, and it, from a genetic perspective as well, which is a separate issue to the religious one and the cultural one, but there is obviously a very strong overlap between what people whom we call Germanic and people that we call Celtic today.
Right. I've seen some genetic evidence that implies that especially along the France and German border, that the line between what is German and what is Celtic is it overlaps quite a bit, and sometimes you'll get spots of Germans inside France or Celts inside Germany and whatnot.
That is, if you can even call the French Celtic. I mean, I did say in the video that the term Germanic is, and Celtic have can both be misused, but I think the term Celtic has been very, very frequently and quite consistently misused, and that's what that's why I put that Tolkien quote in, because when we say Germanic, we are either everyone knows that you're talking either about people who are who speak a Germanic language, or people who worship the Germanic gods or whatever. But when we say Celtic, we're very often talking about people who don't speak Celtic languages and don't worship Celtic gods. And sometimes it's kind of like, well, why do they say Celtic? Because, oh, well, someone used to worship that god there, but these gods there or something, or they used to speak that language there. But that's not really a consistent, you can't apply that consistently. And when we say, for example, in Britain, like how much Anglo-Saxon DNA do we have? We judge that by the criteria of how much DNA do we have from the people who brought Germanic languages to Britain. But when we say how much Celtic DNA we have, we don't judge that by how much DNA do we have from the people who brought Celtic languages to Britain, which is, so it's, the same standards aren't applied. People say that they just class everyone who was there before the Anglo-Saxons as Celtic, even though we know that the pre-existing population of Britain before the Germanic invasions was basically the same as what it had been at the time of the original Indo-European invasion of the British Isles by the Belbeker people from Holland. So I'm just saying that Celtic culture is fascinating. It's something worth looking into and stuff, but oftentimes people are inconsistent in their application of the term Celtic.
Yeah. And there's
I think that's very fair.
Within in Nirona society, we do a lot of research into like the different texts and evidence and stuff from the various cultures, like you got the Saxons and the Scandinavians, and then you look at the Lombards and like all these different peoples throughout Europe. And one thing that we stumble upon very frequently is that these people didn't really necessarily see each other as different. They very much saw themselves as one kind of people. There wasn't really a difference between the Saxons and like these people over here, these people. They very much viewed themselves as one people. So, Mr. Tom, I actually have a religious question for you. And I get this question a lot from people that are of more like maybe Irish descent, because over here in the States, we have, especially here in the Northeast, we have a lot of people of Irish descent. And they get the question, because of how much Celtic mythology and Celtic lore and stuff was lost, they want to know if they're able to practice the Germanic faith tastefully. Is it authentic if an Irish person practices also true, for example? Would you say that is authentic, or what's your opinion on that?
Well, I did a whole video on this question of heritability and like the connection of blood and religion, but it was for patrons only, because I only wanted people who were really interested to get in, and don't want to just get into major debates or everyone. But it's a difficult one, because I can't say that you certainly wouldn't be looking at historical behavior. It certainly isn't true to say that they excluded people who weren't of the exact same blood as them, because they intermarried with foreign women all the time. They took women and then, you know, expanded in that way. That's what all European peoples generally did.
I do think it's relevant to note that that generally happens from a paternal perspective. It's a very patriarchal sense of viewing it.
So the Indo-European culture is extremely patriarchal, and they would definitely see, like, if you have a mother from one culture and a father from another, you would follow that of the father. It doesn't really make a difference what your mother is in that respect. You follow the way of the fathers. But, you know, when someone says that an Irish American, someone who has Irish heritage, I mean, your main culture is an American culture, not Irish, to be fair. And in America, it's a country founded by Germanic people, mainly, not Irish people. It was founded by British and Dutch people, mainly English and Dutch people, mainly. So with some German immigrants as well. So it's primarily and originally a Germanic culture, as Thomas Jefferson said. So you're living in a Germanic culture in that respect. And also, like, there's a lot of overlap with Irish and Germanic. And I mean, it's really a case-by-case basis for whether it's authentic or not. If you're completely immersed in Irish culture, and then perhaps it would be an authentic view to do that. But it's also a matter of belief. Like, do you actually believe in the gods of Germanic people? If not, then of course it's inauthentic. And I mean, there are although when you're saying this thing about so much being lost from Celtic myth, in a way they have more than the Germanics. In a way, they have less, because in terms of overall sources talking about mythology, they have much more. They have a lot. But the problem is those sources aren't, none of them are written down in the way that Snorri wrote down the Germanic ones.
Right. They're very, they have a very corrupted perspective written by a, you know, priests who are saying these are the superstitions of these people and we're going to discuss them because they're wrong, which is very different from the way Snorri wrote it.
Well, Snorri was also Christian, of course, as well, but a Christian chieftain. But the difference is, the main difference is Snorri wanted to portray the Germanic traditions in a coherent way. And that may have been a distortion, or certainly was a distortion in many ways, because certainly there would have been many, many variations on the myths regionally. They weren't the same every way, but he wanted to make it all packaged into one thing that made a bit more sense in the Eddas. So that's actually very helpful for us, because people today who are reviving the ancestral religions and trying to understand them, because we want some coherence. But the Celtic ones are much more higgledy-piggledy, and they're very, and we have a lot more variations in them and things like that. So
much more humoristic as well.
Yeah, they're often turned into humans, but we can see an example of the equivalent in Germanic culture with Saxo Grammaticus, where Odinus, who is Odin, his story is about Odinus being a man who got cucked by his wife or whatever, is a euhemerized version, much in the same way that the Irish had euhemerized depictions of their gods. So, I mean, the problem with Celtic paganism is that the sources are so diverse, and there's so much, and there's so many interpretations that are possible. And also, of course, that Celtic paganism was up until when I became a pagan 10 years ago now, the main paganism, all pagans I met were Celtic pagans. There weren't, this Viking popularity wasn't there 10 years ago like it is now. And I was really annoyed. I wanted to get Anglo-Saxon and Viking cultures more. I'm certainly not worried about Vikings being more popular now. They're too popular almost, but the Germanic stuff was secondary, because the Celtic thing had been massive since the 19th century. Like, people started calling themselves Druids back in Victorian times and dressing up that way.
Right. But it has a lot of overlap with what we could generously refer to as New Age religions.
Precisely.
Very few people who claim Celtic religion are something that would be like a Reconstructionist, authentic Celtic religion. Yeah, it's very Wiccan-y.
They tend to have more in common with Gerald Gardner than they do the Druids of yesteryear.
Right, exactly. And that's a problem. I suppose someone who was looking at at Celtic religion seriously might just think this is too bogged down in New Age-iness, and the original sources are so complicated and hard to interpret that I just don't think I can practice it as a religion, and maybe Germanic would be easier. So, yes, that's true. I guess I can sympathize with that perspective. I think as for whether it's authentic in terms of their ethnicity, I think that's a... There's another question. All Irish people have Viking DNA. That's a fact. And all Irish people probably have some English DNA too. So,
we know from when the Norse people conquered parts of Ireland that many of the Irish people did in fact convert to Nordic paganism. That's so, I mean, this does have a historical precedency to it.
I can also say recently the Viking DNA samples that came out, 9 of them are on the Eurogenes blog, where he's put them on a PCA for you to see. 3 of which are classed as pure Viking, and they plot quite close to modern day Swedes, even more pure than modern day Swedes, if you want to use the term pure for this context. 3 of them are called mixed, and they sort of plot around like British people, so they've probably been mixed with British people. And 3 of them have been classed as Gaelic Vikings, and they literally plot like Irish people. So they with a slight admixture of Viking admixture. So the Gaelic Vikings seem to have had more Irish DNA than a Nordic DNA, but they're still Viking in the archaeological context. Then the majority,
right, almost like they just sort of wholesale ported over to the now dominant culture.
Yeah, well, basically, if some Viking guys came over, took local wives, and then have children, and they're raised as Norsemen, and then they go and look out for get some more Irish wives. Each generation, the Viking blood diminishes by half, but the culture, right, culturally, Norsemen rather than Gaels, because they're not immersed in the Gaelic culture, they're immersed in the Norse culture, but by blood they're Gaels.
Mm. Now, before we get too far, because we could talk about this all day, I wanted to get into back into the Yule stuff. You mentioned something earlier that was really, really fascinating. This is something that I really, really love about the Yuletide season. You mentioned that there's kind of like a spooky vibe about it. Almost has something very, very much in common with like Halloween, or is what we would call winter nights. And like over here, if you go to, I believe they do it in Philadelphia, they do a Krampuslauf, which is everybody dresses up as monsters or Krampus and run down the street and scream and get rowdy. And you know, so there is a very spooky thing about it. And I was listening, I was mentioned earlier, I have a, you know, I don't care how boomer it is, I have a Christmas music playlist that I have that I like to listen to. And I love the season music. I'm a big Dean Martin fan. That doesn't matter. But I was listening to the Santa Claus is Coming to Town song, and I'm listening to Santa Claus Coming to Town, and you listen to the lyrics, and it's not only is it very spooky in the lyrics, that Santa Claus has this kind of like bizarre, omnipresent feel that he's watching everything you do, waiting to give you judgment. It also has a very Odinic feel to it. If you think about it, you think about the lyrics. You know, you listen, it's like, you better watch out, you better not cry. And he says, he has a list, he's checking it twice. This is very, very Odinic, because it says, you know, there's like a lot in folklore that during the Yuletide season, the Allfather Odin is listening to the conversations of men through the campfires, and he's listening to them, he's listening to what they're saying, and he's learning their wisdom. And this idea of having this knowledge of everybody, we all know that Odin sends out his ravens, which represent thought and memory. They're two parts of his soul components, out into the world of men to learn the wisdom and travel throughout the plains, and then they come back to him. This is very reminiscent of Santa Claus. You go and you listen to all these lyrics, it just sounds very Odinic. What do you think about my little gnosis there, Mr. Tom?
Well, certainly you're not the first person to recognize an Odinic parallel in Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, as you call him in the USA. There's a lot been said about that. You know, his name, one of his names in the Eddic literature is Yulefather, which is Yule Father. And we call him Father Christmas. We call Santa Claus Father Christmas here. And Father Christmas in UK was merged with the continental figure, the Germanic or German figure of Santa Claus, who comes from St. Nicholas. But originally we didn't connect St. Nicholas, who is a recognized saint in the English church, with the figure of Father Christmas, who was in Victorian times, a physical embodiment of the Christmas season. And he looked very similar. He had a big, long beard.
Mr. Tom, you're cutting out, sir.
So have you got me now?
Yep, I got you.
Yes, we do.
So did you... Okay, where did you lose me? From the beginning?
You were just talking about Father Christmas is very similar to Santa Claus. He has a long beard.
Yeah, so Father Christmas was depicted in Victorian cartoons. Like, he's not fat like Santa Claus. He's not wearing red clothes. He's wearing green or blue. But it's similar in the fact he's got this kind of hat and warm jacket, and he's got a long beard.
Looks like Gandalf.
He looks like Gandalf. He rides a goat sometimes, and that's not clear why, because the Yulebock tradition is in Sweden, and the Krampus tradition is in the Alps, and that's a goat-looking man. But we don't see anything in between Sweden and the Alps. And then suddenly in Victorian England, we see this Father Christmas figure riding a goat, but we don't know where that goat comes from or what it means. Really, like, why did all these separate parts of Germanic-speaking Europe have horned goat things associated with Christmas? Don't know. But it's possible related to something pagan from a long time ago. And Father Christmas, although he may not himself be literally Odin, he certainly is Odinic. And although we can't trace him back all the way to pagan times, his name, even, Father Christmas, as I said, is the same as Yule Father, which is one of the names of Odin in the Eddas. So, and he drinks from a bowl of wassail, which is a pagan tradition as well in England that goes back to Anglo-Saxon times. Wassail is a greeting, and also it means be you healthy. And it also is a drink of hot cider. And it's also a tradition where we have in England still in January, where people sing wassail to the trees, to apple trees, to make them fruitful in the following harvest season. Yeah. So there's certainly all these pagan, completely different pagan themes interlocking with the Father Christmas and Santa Claus traditions, but they're all also different, and it's hard to connect them to each other from the north and the west and the south Germanic areas, and also to connect these disparate traditions back to Odin. But yes, certainly to call them Odinic is accurate because for many reasons. And also, I think the thing you point out about the death, the thing that's especially Odinic is this idea of, I think, is association that some people get and some people want to have, or not everybody has, of associating Christmas with a kind of feeling of the dead, like ghosts and stuff. Ghost stories in Britain have now become a thing, have been for a few decades now, back in fashion for as a Christmas thing. And also it was in Victorian times a Christmas thing. What was Yule to the Germanic people? Certainly a festival in which the dead were remembered, Odin himself being Lord of the Dead. Mm-hmm. It's a time when we're remembering ancestors and that we're toasting them in a feast. And it's a time when it's one of these liminal periods in the year when.
It's interesting you say that. I've never considered that aspect before. But one of the other major deities we see associated with Yule in the Scandinavian traditions is the god Freyr, who, yes, as we know, can also be connected to the concept of the ancestors through his rule of Alfheim. And I think that is actually very accurate. You might have something with that there, that it was very much a remembrance of ancestors or a liminal period.
Yes, that's another thing that's confusing about Yule, because people often want to stay connected to one day, but what we see in the sources is that there's certainly a celebration involving the bringing in of a boar onto which people hold the bristles and make oaths on it. And this is the boar that is also sacrificed at Yule. And that this boar is obviously going to be associated with Frey, because Frey, right, is associated with boars. And now we have in England the tradition for, and in Sweden as well, the traditional food before it was turkeys and goose and things was always pork. You'd eat pork. And that must be from the original traditional food.
Yeah, so that's a thing in America as well. We have the tradition of the Christmas ham everyone eats.
That's what they have in Sweden, the Christmas ham. Up in Pennsylvania, we do pork and sauerkraut.
That's very German, yeah. But the and also in Sweden they have a tradition of making marzipan pigs called julgrisen, meaning Christmas pigs. So why is the pig a thing? It must be back to this old boar that was associated with Frey. But then, so when we assume, okay, Yule must have been a feast for Frey. But then when we look at other sources, Frey is completely absent. The saga of Håkon the Good, it describes the toasts go to Odin. And then also when we look at this account of a Byzantine emperor and his Germanic Varangian guard celebrating Yule and shouting Yule, 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 and dancing around the table in masks, this seems more like the Odin cult with the masking.
Grimmel, oh, certainly. A very an ecstatic dance cult is definitely Odinic in origin there. Though right. I think
and
you're right there. It has
Grimmel, which means masked. So the masking, right, is certainly going to, and even today, recently in times, in early modern Britain, we have evidence that masking was still a part of Christmas, and alcoholism has been very much, even in, like, going in the early modern period, Christmas was quite a rough occasion in, like, the 1500s, and the Puritans tried to ban it. Now, it wasn't necessarily pagan, but it certainly wasn't typically Christian either. It was just people getting very drunk, and it certainly wasn't about children as it is now. Children,
right. If I remember correctly, even in the Scandinavian tradition, Yule just continued until the alcohol ran out, which is, of course, a great tradition. We should definitely bring that one back.
So it's certainly been always a kind of a time when people don't behave normally. They're allowed to drink more and misbehave in a way. But the what I was trying to make the point before about why is it that some sources clearly is a feast relating to a pig or a pig slaughter relating to Frey, but also there's a horse slaughter, mm-hmm, and a horse sacrifice, and that's relating to Odin. Well, that's because, as you pointed out, with the feast going on for many days, what we understand from the Germanic calendar is that Yule was 2 months long. It wasn't one day like Christmas Day. It was 2 months. And within those 2 months, I believe there were several separate festival dates to different deities, one of which was to Frey, another of which was to Odin, and another probably to the Disir, which is like Modernicht in the Anglo-Saxon sources, the Night of the Mothers. There's something to do with them.
Yeah. Yeah. The Disablot. But one of the
so it's kind of like a huge festival.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the research projects that we're doing in Around a Society is Mr. Tristan. It seems you have a little bit of background noise, if you don't mind muting.
Oh yeah,
it's all good. So one of the projects that we're doing in Neurona Society is taking a real good hard look at the authentic sources when it comes to, you know, the holidays and stuff, because we very much have a very modern look. If you look at like how you also true or, you know, modern pagans practice our holidays, you have like the wheel of the holidays and stuff like that, which is all fine and good. Like, it's nothing, there's nothing wrong with it. But people are very fixated on dates. Like, you know, Mother's Night is on the 20th of December, and then it goes through 12 days. You know, this like Ostara is on the 21st of March, whatever it is. And then, you know, we were very fixated on dates when our ancestors weren't like that. It was just a large period of time. And we're looking at this, that these are our ancestors were practicing. They would say, all right, this begins this day, and then it just goes on till whenever, and then there's a midpoint whenever we have, whenever we want to do it. So it wasn't, they weren't very fixated on dates like we are today. And it's really, really, you know, fascinating.
I think that there was one, if I may interject, there was one sense of date that was important to them. And this is what, this is an idea I got from the Brute Norse blog originally, which is run by a historian who I respect called Erik Sturesund, who's a Norwegian. And he, based on his understanding of the Norse calendar, it was lunar solar. So it was very conscious of like the things like the solstice, but it wasn't just like people have assumed now that they celebrated Yule on the solstice. He's saying, no, it was like the first full moon after the solstice. Yeah. So they used the positions of the sun and the moon in conjunction to calculate what their holy days were. And this is also what some friends of mine also been looking at, how that relates to Anglo-Saxon, what we know about Anglo-Saxon traditions, and it all adds up quite well. It seems that they had the same thing. And in that case, solstice at the moment is usually a few days before Christmas, 21st, 22nd in Britain, in the Northern Hemisphere. But then the first full moon after that, well, this year that will be on the 10th. But a lot of old, really old Christmas tradition stuff here in Britain, like the wassailing I mentioned before, where people sing songs to the trees to try and make them fruit, that takes place around that point, just in the second week of January. So that I thought was interesting, and maybe that's because of a memory of the older calendar that we used to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people don't know that the word month actually comes from, you know, the word moon, month. That's where it all comes from. But you mentioned something earlier, and I just wanted to mention this. We're kind of going over and we're looking at all of these ways that the Yuletide culture and all these like different archetypes of whatever, whether it's the Yule book or Father Christmas, they just permeate throughout all of Europe. And I was listening to the Christmas list, and a song by Lou Monte, Dominic the Donkey, comes up. And I'm listening to Dominic the Donkey, and right away I thought about the Yule book. Like, Dominic the Donkey comes in the town and stuff like that. You know, Santa Nicola comes to town and brings El Chuchulil and, like, all that stuff. Could Dominic the Donkey be Yule book in Italy?
I don't know what that is. Sorry.
It's an Italian-American Christmas song that's it's pretty popular. It's good stuff. So you should add that to your list.
I spent many Christmases in Italy because my family lived there for well over 10 years in Italy. My stepmother is Italian, so my half sisters are all half Italian. Uh-huh. And I used to go to Milano for Christmas. It's very nice to see that all the Italian traditions, but I don't remember this. The donkey I remember from Catholic school when I was little, the donkey that carried Mary. Is that the Dominic the Donkey?
No, it's literally a donkey that hangs out with Santa Claus and comes around and gives kids presents. That's literally what the song's about. It's I'm guessing Lou Monte is Southern Italian, so maybe it's a tradition down there. But speaking of the Italian tradition, a lot of people have this kind of nowadays have this view that the Mediterranean cultures and the Northern European cultures are completely and utterly different. When a lot of people don't realize that Germanic tribes raided Italy, like after the fall of Rome, and the Italian people of today have a lot of Germanic DNA, and a lot of their culture is very Germanicized. How much of Germanic like Christmas did you see in Italy, or if any?
Well, I'd say that the actual extent to which the Italy was Germanized has been quite like well looked at in recent studies. There's been that study from medieval Lombards, who were basically Swedes living as an elite in Sweden, in Italy. And then more recently, they've looked at how the changing genetic profile of people in Rome, in that Roman genetic study going from the Imperial Republic, the Republic to the Imperial to the medieval times. And the Germanic DNA comes in the early medieval era, and it comes quite, there's quite a lot of it there. But then afterwards, things settle, and actually modern Italian people don't have that much. They're not like people from Imperial times. Imperial times, the people in Rome were very diverse, with more Eastern DNA. Then when the Germans came in, they became more Germanic. And that now Italians are more just like Italian, to be honest, because a lot of the Italian, there were a lot more Italian people, and they just, you know, overwhelmed all the foreigners who were, had moved into the peninsula. But the parts of Christmas, the parts of Italy that I was in for Christmas in Lombardia were, excuse my pronunciation if any Italians watching, because Lombardia, I don't know how you pronounce it. That was very Germanic, because not because they all have lots of German DNA necessarily, just because it's very close to Germany. Mm-hmm. And to be and like, they have German Christmas markets, but so does Ireland, so does England, so does Sweden. German Christmas markets are the definitive Christmas market of Europe. And actually German, I'd say Christmas in Europe is more influenced by Germany than any other country, because Germany somehow has become the main influencer of how people celebrate Christmas. Especially Victorian German traditions were exported all around Europe quite a lot. And that's partly because a lot of countries like Sweden very much admired Germany. The British, we had a royal family then of German origin, and they imported a lot of German traditions when Victoria and her family were the first to have Christmas trees in Britain, and then everyone else just copies the Queen. When she had a Christmas tree, everyone had to have a Christmas tree. So, and it's similar in North Italy, like the Christmases seem very German. You got like the pine and snow. It's very snowy in Northern Italy. It's more snowy in North Italy than it is here in England. So it felt very, you know, alpine. And I don't like to overstate the Germanic influence on, I mean, there could be a massive Germanic influence on culture. I mean, I think the guy who invented Italy was a German, wasn't he? The guy who like found like what the guy who sort of unified the idea of an Italian country. As far as my history is not so good on that area, but the actual overall contribution of German DNA in Italy, even in the north, isn't that especially high, I wouldn't say.
Oh, really?
So, Tom, do you think that the modern beliefs surrounding Christmas, including the rise of the Santa figure in popular culture, this as you mentioned, it's such a strong German sort of Germanic area to Christmas now. Do you think this is part of an active deific influence upon society, or is it more like a passive cultural assimilation, something that's not conscious? Or is it perhaps, like a sort of a passive folk memory kind of resurgence? What would you say?
Well, the popularity of Santa Claus and an figure in that sense, you mean?
Yes, I mean not only Santa Claus, but the rise of the German tradition of Christmas as a sort of as you were mentioning, a wide European market that's become the definitive Christmas.
I don't think it's folk memory. I think it's something else. I think it's because the German form of Christmas was something that has historically developed. For example, the Christmas tree, I don't even think that's originally Germanic. I think that the Lutheran like elites, aristocratic Prussians in Lithuania, witnessed this custom among the in Prussia, you know, in the Baltic, among the Baltic peoples. That they would decorate a tree. Now that might have pagan provenance. It may be originally a Baltic pagan tradition. I don't know.
And wasn't Lithuania the last country to convert to Christianity?
That's correct. The last in Europe to convert. So it might be something that was a Baltic pagan tradition, but it doesn't necessarily mean it was at the time the Germans witnessed it. And when the Germans changed it, originally, even at that time, it was only decorating a tree in the town square, not in the house. Then the Germans changed it when they brought it back to Germany, the Lutherans, where they had the idea that you bring the tree inside. And then when the Victorian aristocracy copying the Queen doing it, it's for their reasons. And then when the Americans are bringing it and commercializing it in their way, it's a different thing. So I think a lot of Europe is very, very, very influenced by America. You might not realize in America how much American culture has changed Europe. It's enormous influence in every single country. So that's standardizing things of how Christmas looks. Like, for example, Father Christmas or Father Christmas / Santa Claus did not exist in Scandinavia at all. But now they have him because they used to have Yule Bock. So Yule Bock wasn't a straw model that they made like these ones. That's also something that's changed. Originally, Yule Bock was their equivalent of Father Christmas. And someone in the family would dress up as a goat, knock on the door, and then, like, you know, come in, and then kind of like the Loki, he would come in and start insulting people and saying inconvenient truths about them, and eventually they'd give him enough alcohol that he'd go away. But this also would scare the children a bit and that kind of thing. But then this is now given over to Jultomte, which means the Christmas Tomte. Now Tomte itself means. And it's kind of like an elf. It's like a house spirit, which probably the Tomte almost certainly derived from idea and ancestral spirits that have been changed into little elves. But elves also are ancestral spirits. Right. But
although the various Landvater that our ancestors would have worshipped, it's just kind of been melded by the Victorians into the pixies and elves.
But the Yule Tomte is not actually a Tomte. He's Father Christmas or Santa Claus in the American sense, but they've imported that culture from America, that figure of Santa Claus, and then renamed him Yule Tomte. Whereas Santa Claus is a German thing, but it doesn't mean it's Germanic broadly, because in Holland they have Sinterklaas, which is the same thing. Mm-hmm. But in Scandinavia, they'd never had that until recently. So a lot of this like Germanness of Christmas is something that's occurred in the last 150 years, I'd say, and it's been perpetuated partly by the Victorian British, and even more so by the Americans.
So you would take the position that it is in fact more of an organic and natural cultural assimilation?
Well, I think perhaps it's also to do with the fact that German Christmas, just like the idea of Christmas as being a cold, snowy time, is very... It makes sense in Germany. It doesn't snow in England in December. It snows in February sometimes, but it doesn't snow here. But we picked up, I mean, by the time Dickens wrote Christmas Carol, it was very cold in England. And that was the last time the Thames froze over. And that's he remembered that when he was writing. So yeah, Christmas time used to be much colder in England back then. But like a lot of parts of England, of Europe, it's not that cold, but snow, certainly in Germany, and it's very, you get snow more in Christmas time. So I think maybe that helps, like when we see America, where you have like, you do get Christmas snow, and even in New York City, whatever, like we want, everyone's having this globalized view of things now, and we want to think of it in that way of being this winter cult, this icy winter wonderland. And so the German version of that matches up really well. And it's just, it might just be that it's organic. I'd say it's organic, but it's hard to tell exactly how it's happened, but I don't think it's a folk memory or anything like that. Like, I think some other things could be attributed to folk memory. Perhaps the emergence of the figure of Father Christmas and Santa Claus are themselves folk.
Right. That's part of what I was trying to get at. Some of the aspects of Christmas could be a sort of a deific influence upon modern culture.
Right. Well, certainly like even the Christmas tree itself doesn't go back to ancient Germanic paganism, as some have claimed it does. It could be true that the desire to honor and decorate a tree in this way is a folk memory of the times when we used to do that as pagans, and that we just...
Well, we have the tradition in Germanic peoples of the Yule log, in which they would bring in a big tree and then slowly roast it in the fire. We get from that to the idea of we'll bring in a tree and decorate it. I mean, it's not a huge conceptual leap.
No, but by the time, I don't know how the Yule log in Britain in its current form is made of, is a cake in the shape of a log. We don't have an actual log anymore, but I have heard some rural parts of England, maybe they still do have a log. It's certainly not a tree, it's a log that they burn.
Right. I can say that a lot of American families do still have the tradition of a Yule log, though we don't use a tree. It's generally just a very big log they put in a fireplace, but...
That might be, that might have pagan provenance. I don't know. The fact that the interesting thing about the fact that in England it's called a Yule log is that's interesting, because while in Scandinavia the term Christmas is always called Yule, it hasn't got that other name. In England, the term Yeol, from which is the cognate of Swedish Yule or Old Norse Yol, Yeol was even in Anglo-Saxon times, they replaced that, they're trying to replace that word with Christmas. So the fact that we've retained the word Yule for the description of that log and is quite interesting, and that does indicate that it's probably very old and possibly pre-Christian, because otherwise they would call it a Christmas log, because the word Christmas is like really old in England. It goes back 1500 years, so like it, not 1500 years, sorry, like over 1300, 1200 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's possible some of these things are directly descended from pagan traditions that we've preserved, but I think it's more likely a lot of them are not, but they are a kind of reawakening of a spirit in our folk memory, that a desire to remember a bearded man who rides in the sky at night, and to remember the importance of honoring a tree in a certain context.
Yeah. I have the position that I really like this. If you go back, you listen to this whole podcast here, we're talking all about all of these various aspects and these archetypes and these things that all have correlation and all look like each other. And while we can't definitively prove any of this stuff, where they come from, and a lot of, like you're talking about the Christmas tree, we can't really prove. We just don't know. The Yule log, we just don't know. You know, these the Odinic figure of Father Christmas, we just don't know. But to me, it's like it's so hard to say, well, you know, these things are just unrelated or whatever. So to me, I actually agree very, very strongly with what Tristan's original question was. I believe very strongly that this is a divine influence upon our society and upon our folk memory and our folk consciousness. And I, you know, how many of us are reverting back to the ancient religion, or at least having like interest in it, or feel something from it? It resonates with us. So I sincerely believe that this is indeed, I mean, this is just me. This, I'm not saying that, you know, I can't, obviously can't prove this, but all of these correlations is just, it's just too much to not think that there's some sort of divine influence coming back from the ancient times. What do you think about that?
Well, as a believer, I believe, or of course, I believe everything has divine influence. There's always the work of a divine hand in everything. So I definitely agree with in that sense. But also, we can, one thing no one will deny, not even the most skeptical person can deny, there was a pagan festival in midwinter among Germanic people called Yule. And that, and then if you want to talk about pagan origins of Christmas, when you've got that 100% bona fide fact there.
So one last question for you before we shut it down. How are you going to celebrate your Yule? Because I know that you are a practicing pagan guy. How are you going to celebrate?
Well, I'm already celebrating it now, because to me, this is the first of the Yule months. I've been in the first Yule month now, and I go around visiting different family members. I'll spend some time staying with them and eating and drinking with them. And that will correspond. Most of my family are Catholic, so they'll be celebrating at the normal Christian times. But I will also afterwards in January on the full moon, the Yule moon, as I call it, I will invite some local pagans, some friends to my house for a Yule feast. And I am looking, I'm in talks with an organization that provides horse meat. So locally, that they butchered local horses. So I want to get horse meat for the Yule feast, as it's the proper pagan tradition on for Odin, because he wants a horse sacrifice. So the meat of the horse can then be dedicated to him. And then when we eat from it, we'll all be, you know, blessed by the association of the blessing to Odin. So that is my intention. And then also we'll just drink alcohol and read from some poems. I'll encourage everyone to read passages from the Eddas, or read Germanic poetry, or make up a song or a funny poem and stuff. In this kind of festive like sense, it's a fun occasion. It's a holy occasion, but it's not like a normal holy occasion, because there's this kind of jovial and jolly aspect. And even the word jolly is possibly etymologically related to your Yule. It's a interesting little tidbit there.
Which is also, I've read that it's connected to the word yell.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Yule connected to the word yell, apparently. I don't know how true. I'm not an etymologist or anything like that, but that's just what I've read. See, that's very, very cool, Mr. Tom. Me personally, Yule for my kindred is a big deal, because that was when we consecrated. My kindred has been together for, this is going to be 7 or 8 years. I can't remember. We've been together. We've been practicing every single Yule. Yule is a big time for us, specifically Mother's Night, which is what we practice on the solstice of the 20th or 21st. We practice Mother's Night on the 20th going into the 21st when it goes down, because our ancestors very much viewed that when the sun went down, it was the next day. So that's how we practice it, and we have a Fesla, which is a feast, and you know, because you know, I'm half Paisan, we do some stuff. You know, we have bazel cookies, and we do some stuff like that. But at the end of the night,
panettone.
What's that?
You heard that panettone?
No, what's it's, that?
Oh, well, that's what my family in Italy used to have. It's a Christmas cake that they eat there, like this big yellow fluffy thing, and they pour mascarpone on it, or zabignone. I can't remember. It's like this alcoholic egg white stuff, or maybe it's different in south of Italy. I don't know that well.
No, actually, in south of Italy, the tradition is Christmas Eve, you do seven fish. You have a seven fish dinner.
Oh, yeah, same in the north. Yeah. It's Catholic tradition in England as well. You used to fast before Christmas. You can only eat fish. You can't eat meat. So so it comes from that. Like, you're not supposed to, on the eve, you fast, you don't eat meat, and then Christmas Day you can eat meat. But instead of fasting, they just eat lots of really nice fish instead.
Oh, yeah, we do smelts, we do spaghetti and anchovies, we do calamari soup, octopus, all kinds of squingili, all that kind of stuff. But that's what I do with my mom's family. But when my kindred gets together, we have our vesla, we do our pork and sauerkraut, we have some, you know, various snacks and stuff, and we drink our mead. I have a mead maker in my kindred who's absolutely tremendous. And
nice.
We get a little rowdy, we sing some songs, we let the kids run amok, and we get a little wild. But at the end of the night, we do our bloat, and our bloat is a very solemn, very devout practice. And you know, you guys could watch the Nerona Society video on Hallowed Guide to Bloat. Actually, Mr. Tom, I think you shared that video some time ago.
Yeah, it's great. Good video. A really good guide for people, especially if they're just getting started and they want to know about practice. I thought that was a really cool video. Can I ask also the both of you, if I may, if the interviewed may become an interviewer for a moment,
absolutely.
Which deity will your block be focus to Frey or Odin?
Tristan?
Well, I think primarily we have to recognize that Odin is the primary Yule figure.
Yeah. My kindred is a little, obviously, Odin being the Yule father is very much like the focus of the Yuletide celebration. However, when we get together for our Yule Vesla, it's on Mother's Night. That's when we practice the Disablot, and that is when actually my kindred, our patron deity, is the All Mother Frigg. So we give thanks to Frigg and we make offerings to Frigg, and that's kind of like, that's our girl. And we, you know, we always bring up all our grandmoms and aunts and all the people that we've lost and we miss, and it's a very heartfelt ceremony that we do. But obviously the entirety of the Yuletide is dedicated to the Allfather, the Yule Father, Odin. But on Mother's Night we dedicate it to Frigg.
That's nice. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I like that you bring up all your grandmother's names and stuff like that. I think that's important, because when sometimes people get a bit too vague when they talk about ancestor worship. I think you should really invoke the real names of your ancestors, you know. And I sometimes visit the actual graves of ancestors for rituals, because I think that's a, you know, when people went to burial mounds in the old days, that was because that was, they knew the person in the mound. Whereas, and I sometimes do rituals at burial mounds, of course, but sometimes it's good to just go to an actual grave where I know the person's name who was in it and exactly my relation to them, because then I feel like I can really call upon them for assistance, because they're more likely to feel a sense of kinship with me.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, when I first started getting into heathenry and also true and stuff, a lot of times bloats, people would hail like these, heroes of yesteryear, people in the stories and stuff, which is wonderful. Like, there's nothing at all wrong with it. But me personally, and something that I've noticed that it's a trend as our faith becomes more authentic, I guess you could say, people are hailing their recent loved ones. And that's something our Disabloat is very much like that. You're going to hear grandma, you're going to hear Nana, you're going to hear Aunt so-and-so, you're going to hear all these people, and it's a very, very heartfelt ceremony. People sometimes, you break down, start crying because they miss their Nan so much. And that's what's so special about this, and that's what's so intimate and wonderful about this religion, is it's not so much like, going to the church and you sit in a pew among a big crowd of people and stuff, which is if you're Catholic or whatever, no disrespect to you if that's what your tradition is. More power to you. I have so many family members that are still devout traditional Catholics, and I have so much love for them. But to me, what makes our faith so special is it's so intimate, and it does give so much thanks and blessings and remembers those that have been in our lives recently. And it's just a really, really special occasion, and it's a wonderful tradition that we have.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool. Very cool. Okay, we are at an hour here. Mr. Tristan, do you have anything in conclusion?
No, I think I'm all fine here, Dave.
Wonderful. Mr. Tom, do you have anything in conclusion for us?
Only one thing. Have a wonderful Yule. Remember your ancestors and honor the gods. And also, if you want to buy my book, check out www.smiletitans.com. You can see it there. It's called The Spirit of Yule.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'll absolutely have that link down in the description as well. Mr. Tom, thank you so much for coming back on The Bog, man. I love your work. Everything you do is tremendous. Many blessings to you. Very Merry Yule to you and your family and your loved ones. And we'll see you soon. And everybody make sure, I'm going to have his link. Everybody's probably already subscribed, but I'm going to make sure I have the link to all your stuff down there so people could check out all your stuff that you got going on, man. So many wonderful videos coming out of there. Absolutely love it. But like always, guys, thank you so much to all of you. Stay seated, because the next episode we have coming up is from the mighty Jack Young. We're going to talk about the metaphysics of strength. We have a double episode just for you guys for Yule coming from us, me and Tristan here at The Bog. But like always, make sure you like, subscribe, share. Click the little alert button so you can alert every time we go live, which is every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Dave Martell channel. And like always, shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the vampires. They hate you. They sell you poison. It trashes your hair, trashes your body, trashes your skin. Buy some organic, great stuff. Man, Yuletide's coming up, man. Your mom's going to love this. Your sister's going to love this. Your wife is absolutely going to love this. I use it. My mom uses it. My wife uses it. Dr. G uses it. Folkish Farmer uses it. We all use it. We all love it. Grown from the earth, real good stuff. So get some beard oil, get some shampoo, conditioner, some lotion, whatever, man. I swear, you're absolutely going to love it. Opt out of the machine that destroys you. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. Much love. Many blessings to all you guys, man. Hail the gods. Hail the folk. Hail to all of you. I'll see you guys next time. Hail.